Hey everybody, here's what I'd love for you to do. When you walked in, you should have an index card on your chair. Some of you may have sat down very quickly and wondered, what is that sensation? It's an index card. I would love for you to pull that out right now, and you're going to need something to write with, because here's what I want you to do on your individual index card. And we're not going to take long to do this, because I'm of the opinion that everybody in this room, what I'm about to ask you, you should know these things, and they're going to come pretty quickly, hopefully. I'd love for you to take your index card and number it. You can do it in any random number, it doesn't matter. I want you to put the five most important things to you. They can be people, they can be places, they can be things. If you want to summarize people by putting family, you can do that. But I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to write down the five most important things to you on your index card. If you don't have anything to write with, prick your finger, write it in blood, it'll mean more, okay? But you are spending 30 seconds writing down the five most important things to you, okay? On your mark, get set. If we had the Jeopardy theme, it'd be amazing. Go. Look at that. Perfect. Now, everybody look up, stop writing. Here's what you've got to do now. Of the five most important people, places, and things that you wrote down, you have to eliminate one. So take off the one thing that's the least important to you of those five. Scratch them out. And now you're left with four. And of the four that you have left, you have to eliminate one. Which of the four priorities that you have left do you eliminate? Scratch that one out. And now you're left with three. Some of you are smart. You see where we're going. You're left with three, and you have to eliminate the least important thing of those three. Scratch that one out. And now it's incredibly dramatic, because now you're left with two. And of the two things that you say are your priority, I want you to eliminate the one that's the least important. And sir, I just want to say this with all the love in my heart. If you are sitting next to your wife and she wrote down you and your children, you're a goner, okay? It's over for you, because she's eliminating you, bro, and she's keeping the kids, okay? So now you should have one thing on your card, and I want you to look at it. And the question you have to ask yourself is that worthy of it being, or them being, a priority in your life? And I can tell there's some men that are like, bro, you rushed me. I put four-wheeler. No, okay? Is the person, the place, or the thing that you say is the most important, is it really the most important thing to you? And here's the reason why whatever your answer is on that index card is so important. Because whatever you say is most important to you, everybody lean in, has become your mission. It's why you exist. It's why you do what it is that you do. It's the thing that drives you. And here's where we go today. It's a very interesting concept. It's a very interesting idea. Pastor Paul mentioned this, that I get an opportunity. I spend a ton of time in front of the next generation. You need to hear me say unapologetically that I believe in teenagers. I don't think they're the church of tomorrow. I think they're the church of today. One of the greatest things that we could ever do is to underestimate the next generation. I spent this past summer in front of thousands and thousands and thousands of teenagers, and I did the very exercise that I asked you to do. And I asked teenagers, moms and dads. I asked teenagers, aunties and uncles. I asked teenagers, grandparents. I asked teenagers, small group leaders, and church members, what's the most important thing to you? And I want to put a picture up for you to see what they said was the most important thing. Because every out of thousands and thousands of students, the overwhelming majority said that family was the most important thing to them. Family, to which some parents in this room go, my kids were obviously not at that camp. Because here's what you're thinking. You're like, those weren't my kids because, you know, it's like literal hell at my house all the time. So here's where I want us to push for a second, if we could. I would like us to explore how in the world do so many parents and so many churches in our country. I spent time at a church several months ago in upstate New York and in New Jersey that is literally trying to make the choice, do we do away with youth ministry and children's ministry because we feel like failures? We feel like we're not doing well. We feel, and they use this word, that it's impossible. But here's what I would love all of us to consider. Whenever we stop trying to do something that we think is impossible, we settle for a version of life that God never intended for us. When you decide, I'm going to settle because I think this is impossible, and especially for the moms and dads in this room and those of you that care about the next generation, and this is so apropos for where you are in the series that you're talking about, this theme that you have, and I especially think it's very, very advantageous for those of us who sit, all of us sit before the week of Thanksgiving. Some of us in this room, this is where you are. You think that this whole family dynamic is impossible, and when you stop trying to do what's impossible, you will settle for a version of life that God never intended you to have. So what do we do with that? I would remind us, I would take you back, if I may, for those of you that are a little more biblically astute, there is a story, a narrative in the Old Testament, the Jewish people give us about their heritage, about a man who many pastors and business leaders consider one of the greatest leaders to ever exist. His name was Nehemiah. I'm sure your pastor and some of you in this room, you've heard people talk about this. Well, here's what's interesting about Nehemiah for those of you that care. Nehemiah, there's very hard evidence that Nehemiah never, he was not born in the city of Jerusalem. And here's how we know that. The reason we know that is that in 587 BC, Jerusalem, for those of you who don't know, the crown jewel of the Jewish faith tradition, Jerusalem was ransacked and burned by the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar in 587 BC. This is a famous artist's depiction of what happened in Jerusalem. Well, in 587 BC, not only did the Babylonians destroy the city of Jerusalem, but they took thousands and millions of captives of Jews back to Assyria, where they lived. That's part of the reason why, for those of you that care, that Daniel wound up there, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wound up there. The reason why is in 587, the Babylonians came in and ransacked Jerusalem, and for 142 years, Jerusalem sat in ruins. Its gates burned. Its walls deteriorated. And here's what I would like for you to think about. The people that were in Jerusalem at that time, when we pick up on the story of Nehemiah around 445 BC, I want you to think about families that are living, Jewish families living in the ruins of that city. Because all of us can make this estimation, and I don't think it's a stretch, that there were at least two things true of every family and every parent and every child in that city. That they had lived in those ruins for so long that they literally couldn't see or they didn't see how bad things were. They were the frog in the kettle. They had looked around and decided that this is just the way it is in our home. This is just the way it is in our city. They didn't realize how bad things were. Secondly, and this is an incredibly important point for us to understand, is that they had lived in those conditions for so long that they couldn't imagine how things could get better. And this is what I think. I think this room is full of men and women, parents, grandparents, people who care about the next generation, and ladies and gentlemen, it is happening to us in America. We think it's not going to get any better, and we don't realize how bad it really is. Can we imagine for just a second the kids and teenagers growing up in Jerusalem and hearing stories about their faith tradition? I want you to think about a generation who had become so desensitized to their parents' and their grandparents' faith, sitting in the ruins of the crown jewel of their faith and hearing stories about their faith. And don't you know that some smart-aleck 13-year-old at some point looked up and said, "Time out for a second. If I hear the story of Joshua one more time, I'm going to puke. If I hear somebody talk about David killing a giant, I'm going to throw up." Some kid had to have asked his parents, and I want you as an adult to put yourself on the other end of this question. A 13-year-old looking at you in Jerusalem in 445 BC, and their city is ransacked and destroyed. Them asking you, "If this God that you say is so powerful, who Joshua marched around Jericho and the city walls fell, and Moses, took a staff and jammed it in the ground and the Red Sea parted, if David took a rock and killed a giant, then why don't we do something about this?" And if your 13-year-old parents, if your grandchild, grandparents ask you that question, how would you answer them? Would any of us in this room say about this God that we just sang to for about 20 minutes? Well, because it's impossible. Because he doesn't work that way anymore. You may answer that way, but I don't think I have the courage to answer that way. Because here's a heads up, ladies and gentlemen, he still has the ability to move. And if we're going to understand what it is that God's wanting to do in us as families in our country, I think we have to start here. And this is a big, big point for all of us. And if you're taking notes, this would be great for you to write down. You and I have to name what is broken. We've got to name what is broken about the next generation. We've got to name what is broken about our culture. We have to name what is broken. I love the fact that in Nehemiah chapter 1, for those of you that care, Nehemiah is now under the leadership of King Artaxerxes of Persia. He is one of his scribes. He's one of his, he works under him. And he gets word that Jerusalem is in ruins. And this is what we have recorded that Nehemiah said about the crown jewel of the Jewish faith, the city of Jerusalem on a hill. He said, "Those who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace. The walls of Jerusalem are The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." Here's something that I'm learning as a parent. If you cannot name the problem, you cannot fix the problem. If you cannot name it, you cannot fix it. And once you're aware of what the problem is, you become responsible to fixing the problem. And if I may, and this is going to be uncomfortable for some of us in this room, every once in a while, all of us as adults need to take a step back and have a reality check about where the next generation is and what they're about. And here's what I'd like to do quickly, if I may. I would love to give you that reality check. I want to tell, if you're a parent, where are the parents in the room, by the way? Raise your hand high. If your son or daughter was born in the year 1995 or older, your son or daughter is considered Generation Z in our culture. And let me tell you about the common traits about Generation Z. We're going to throw this up on the screen so that you can see this. These are the common characteristics of Generation Z. They are the loneliest generation in the history of our country. For those of you that care, all of the national data statistics are telling us that alcohol and drug abuse are plummeting in our country, while loneliness, depression, anxiety, and suicide are at an all-time high. They're the loneliest generation that's ever existed. They are Wi-Fi enabled. If you don't believe that's true, go to a restaurant that has free Wi-Fi that has teenagers in it, and you will never see their face. You will see the top of their head, because they will have their head down in their thing. They have a digital heartbeat. This generation has a digital heartbeat, and here's what that means. They live in a constant state of comparison and anxiety because they compare everybody else's highlight film to their behind the scenes. They are the most multiracial generation that's ever existed. Multiracial in this sense, that they see color in other people and celebrate it. The issue with Generation Z as it relates to race isn't Generation Z. I need to step on your toes. It's their parents. It's their grandparents. They're the most multiracial generation that's ever existed. They're the most sexually fluid generation that's ever existed. I could spend 6 weeks here talking about sexual fluidity and all that that means with this generation. They are America's first post-Christian generation. Here's basically what that means, that you and I can no longer with this generation assume that when you say the Bible says that they care. I grew up in a time where my dad would say the Bible says, and we didn't even go to church, and I would pay attention. You say that to this generation, they go, so? And I'm of the opinion that it is one of the greatest gifts the church has been given, because here's what you and I get to do. We get to reframe the scriptures and the story of Jesus around the foundation of our faith. And for those of you that are visiting and going, what is Christianity about? It is about, and you've got to reckon with this, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Everybody okay? Jesus rose from the dead. If you don't think that's a big deal, try it. Okay, so he rose from the dead, and our faith is built on that, and we can reframe our faith around the tenets of the gospel that is about that. They are also the most self-directed generation that's ever existed. The reason why they're self-directed is because they are parented by parents. I am the parent of Generation Z children. We have three of them. My generation of parents were parented by helicopter parents. And so my generation of parents reacted to how we were parented, and we decided we're just going to throw our hands up and do whatever we want them to do, because we don't want to raise our kids the way we were raised, because our parents micromanaged us. Or some of you as parents chose to do this. You're not a helicopter parent. You're a lawnmower parent. What you do, instead of you preparing the child for the path, you are mowing the path for your child. But they're self-directed because they have underprotective parents. The reason why they have underprotective parents, my generation of parents, is the first generation in America of parents that do not want to grow old. My parents could not wait to grow old, have grandkids, sit in a rocking chair, and die. That's what they wanted to do. My generation of parents, we're doing everything we can to not grow old. Thus this outfit. All right, so and here's how some of you know that. Some of you as parents in this room, you post on Instagram more than kids. You've got a red Solo cup in your hand more times than not going, chicken, Aflac. You know you do that. And what happens in the meantime is their childhood is disappearing. It does not mean that they're developing faster. They're just experiencing more at a younger age. They're growing older, younger. And when you throw in the fact that pornography, they live in a sexually saturated culture, and at their fingertips are images that most of us never experienced when we were in high school, maybe even college. And this generation can see it anytime, at any place. Psst. I just named what is broken. Maybe the reason why mom and dad, Metro Community Church, small group leader, church leaders, elders, staff members, you feel what you feel, this angst. Maybe the reason why is because you're dealing with a broken generation. And until you and I name it, we can't do anything about it. Until we name what is broken, you can't fix what is broken. And here's where I've got to push. You do not have influence with the next generation because you're right. You and I have influence with the next generation if we care. Sir, ma'am, it doesn't matter if you're right about things. If they don't think you care, it's not going to matter. And it's okay for all of us in this room to pray for a miracle because God knows we need a miracle as it relates to the next generation. It's okay for you to pray for a miracle. It's okay for you to expect for a miracle, but it is not okay for you to wait on one. We've got to name what is broken. And it cracks me up that when you're reading Nehemiah going to his Persian boss, Nehemiah is Jewish. We have every indication that he had never even been. It's a 142-year gap between the time that all of these Jews were taken out of Samaria and Judea to Babylon until Nehemiah wants to come back in 445 BC. So unless he's really, really old, he's never been there. And he makes a plea to his Persian boss. Can I go back and help my people? Can I go back and rebuild this city? And as you're reading chapter 1, all of a sudden, Nehemiah out of nowhere is pleading with his boss. And the very last verse of chapter 1 of the book of Nehemiah, he just out of nowhere blurts out, I was cupbearer to the king. It's the most Forrest Gump thing I have ever seen in the scriptures. Because out of nowhere, he's just like, and that's all I have to say about that. I was cupbearer to the king, Jenna. You know, that's what he says. And you go, why all of a sudden did he just have this brain thing and he wants everybody to know he was the cupbearer to the king? I think there's a couple of reasons. One reason I think he mentioned it was that he wanted everybody to know, listen, I wasn't there when all this started, so this really isn't my responsibility, but I'm going to take responsibility anyway. And here's what I think happens, and I can tell. Some of you in this room, you're my favorite person. You're thinking, well, I'm not a parent, or my kids are preschoolers, or my kids are toddlers, my kids are elementary age, or I'm a grandparent, and I'm done. Thank you, Jesus. You know, I don't have to care about this. Watch this. As it relates to the next generation, you're not responsible because you're a parent. You're not responsible because some of us have this attitude. We learned this in the American church. You're not responsible because you're a pastor. You're responsible. I'm responsible. We're responsible because we're Jesus people. And Jesus people see brokenness and go, I got to go fix that. I got to help there. I can do something. The other reason why I think he said I was cupbearer to the king is that being the cupbearer to the king, for those of you that care, here's what a cupbearer did. He basically tasted the wine before the king drank it because kings were constantly being poisoned by enemies. So Nehemiah was the front guy. If he drank the wine and he died, the king would go, oh, someone tried to kill me. But what came along with that were unbelievable privileges. And here's what I think. There's some men and women within the sound of my voice, and because of who you are, and because of your experience, and because of your influence, and because of your authority, and because of your power, you're like a cupbearer to the king. And my question to you, for the sake of the next generation, is how are you leveraging your influence? What is it that you're doing? Because heads up, ladies and gentlemen, at some point, the national data statistics tell us that one out of every one people die. Everybody okay? Some of you that are mathematically challenged are like, am I in that equation? Yes. And here's what that means for all of us in this room whose mentality is, well, this is our church. It won't always be. At some point, it will be theirs. And how are you leveraging your authority, your influence for the sake of the next generation? He named what was broken, but the second thing that he did was even more brilliant. And it's part of the reason why some of us, it's really easy for you to stay callous and disengaged from this, because as long as you stay a distance away from the brokenness of the next generation, for those of you that care, I've spent since Thursday, I've been in the St. Louis area. There are four or 5,000 youth leaders in downtown St. Louis that are gathered since Thursday. And we are praying, we are seeking God, we are begging him to do something for the next generation. Because there are people just like you, mom and dad, that don't want to lose your kids. They are fighting for you. And sometimes the way that we lose the callousness is we go and see for ourselves. We get close to it. Because can't we just agree for a second? The closer you get to something, the more responsible you feel. It's why when you read the story of Nehemiah, one of the most brilliant things that he did was he got permission from Artaxerxes. I want to go to Jerusalem. And when he gets to Jerusalem, here's what he tells us. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there for 3 days, I set out during the night with a few others. And for those of you that care, here's what he did. He got on horseback, and he rode around the city. And he wanted to know, where are the breaches in the wall? Where are the places that we're going to have to rebuild? Where are their issues? Where are their tension points? And it set a fire in him, because proximity always changes your perspective. The closer that you get to something, the better that you see. And I want to push again for the sake of some of us in this room that are like, imagine if enough of them, we're going to return to this at the very end. Imagine if enough of us in this room decided, before we pass judgment, before we make a statement, before we offer solutions, before we even vote for policies, let me go and see for myself. That's why there are so many parents in this room, of teenagers especially, and you're so grateful for other adults that lead a small group of your teenagers. Right? Because every parent in this room, at some point, your kids tune you out and you want another adult speaking into their life. But here's what I'd love to do tonight quickly. I can't make us all go and work with teenagers, but I would just love for you to go and see for yourself. So I've invited 7 of my friends to come up here. Would y'all give them a hand, because they're nervous as all get out, okay? And y'all hurry up, okay? 7 of you, and we have you marked spots because we know you're teenagers. All right, so stand on the blue things. Where are you going? Okay, I'm going in the dark. No, okay, there you go. 7 of you, y'all got to get, y'all scoochie in so we can get in the light there. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give these 7 some signs to hang around their necks, okay? So here's what I have. You put this one on, doubts about faith. Some of these signs are intense, so just buckle up, buttercup. It's about to get real, okay? Sexual habit or a secret, secrets about parents, self-harm, abuse. You got an easy one, cheating on a test, and sexual identity, okay? So you guys hang these around your neck. Now, here's what you're going to do as the audience. This side is easiest things to share and talk about. This side is most difficult thing to share and talk about. I want you to tell me what order to put them in. This is the easiest thing for a kid to talk about. This is the most difficult thing for a kid to talk about. This is class participation time, so somebody tell me which one should be first as easiest. Cheating on a test. America's education system. All right, here we go. Where's cheating on a test? Oh, you're right over there, so you move over here. Okay, not in the dark. There we go. All right, what's second? Doubts about faith. Everybody cool with that? Where are you, doubts about faith? So you move just to her left, right there. Everybody slide down. All right, what's third? Come on, talk to me. Secrets about parents. So you go to three. There we go. Hey, y'all are doing good. All right, here we go. What's the next one? You've got sexual identity, abuse, self-harm, and sexual habit or secret. You got to talk loud. Self-harm. You guys think that's the easiest of these four to talk about? Sexual identity. These guys are saying sexual identity, so stay put. Look at you, rock star. All right, awesome. All right, of these three, which one's next? There's a parent going, I have no idea. Which one do you think is easiest of these three? Self-harm. So self-harm, flip with abuse. And between abuse and a sexual habit or secret. Abuse would be here before they would share this. No. That was an adamant no, so we're going to flip y'all, okay? Now, here's what you're saying, and I can tell some of you are not satisfied with this, and that's okay. But for the sake of time, this is how we're going to roll. Here's what everybody in the room is somehow coming to a consensus of, that as it relates to these seven things, cheating on a test is the easiest thing to share. Now watch. This is representative of what's easiest to share not only in your church as a teenager, but in your home. And what if, see, some of us in this room, you're thinking, my kid has told me that they've cheated on a test. Well, for all the teenagers here, how many of you in this room at some point in your career cheated on a test? Raise your hand. America. All right, so. But some of us, here's where we are. We're proud that kids feel safe enough, but if this is only as safe as they feel, and all of this is happening in their life, what if, ladies and gentlemen, for Metro Community Church and all your partner churches and all your other campuses, but your home, that your child only feels this safe when there's doubts about faith? Now, the third or fourth time I've been here, Pastor, can we be family? You were honest about cheating on a test. How many of you at some point in your life, and maybe even now, you have doubts about this whole faith thing? Raise your hand. Hi. Higher. And here's what happens in a teenager's life. When a kid talks about, whether it's in a small group or a home, whether it's in their church or their own home, I'm not sure about this. Instead of us vilifying them because you asked a dumb question, what if we decided, you are so incredibly brave for asking a question, period. Secret about parents. Can we just, for the sake of all of us in this room, just admit that every home represented in this place is a mess? We're all a mess. You all came here, and our homes are jacked up. The family would be incredible if it wasn't for people. But here's what happens to a teenager that doesn't feel like they can talk about what's happening at home. They graduate from high school and just assume, well, nobody else ever said anything, so maybe it was just my home. Or maybe that's just what it is. And have you ever considered that maybe the divorce rate is what it is because they couldn't talk about it? sexual identity. Here's a heads up, ladies and gentlemen. If this room was full of 1,000 teenagers, 10 of them would identify themselves as some sort of alternate lifestyle, and 14 of them would tell you that they've had some sort of same-sex attraction. And here's how the church vilifies young men and women who are living in a sexually corrupt, sexually deprived, sexually saturated culture. Instead of us realizing there's a who, we want to bang our hands about our view. Mom and dad, church, on the other side of your view is a kid. And if they can't share it here, where do they go? Where do they go? Self-harm. Child Protective Services tells us that every 11 minutes in our country, there's something going down where some kid is trying to hurt themselves. Usually 14% of them are non-suicidal, or I'm sorry, 14% of them, yes, are actually suicidal. 17% of them, so if this room is full of 1,000 teenagers, consider how many of them either had a thought or actually tried. A sexual habit or secret. I don't know if you read much, but you should, because there is a fallout from the purity movement that happened in the 80s and 90s. And this generation sees so many images that to say purity to them, most of them think, well, that's not me. Because I've seen too much, I've heard too much, and maybe what we need to begin to champion in our homes and in our churches is sexual integrity. And last, abuse. The abuse idea and the self-harm idea come close together. Child Protective Services says every 11 minutes in our country, they have substantiated evidence that a teenager in some way, shape, or form has been abused. And again, if they can't talk about it at home and they can't talk about it here, where do they go? Would you guys give them a hand? Y'all can take those signs off and put them right there. Thank y'all. Y'all can go sit down. Yeah, just put them down. Here's the point, and I'll be quiet. First of all, you just saw for yourself. You got a sneak peek into Generation Z. But here's what I want to leave you with. You do not determine how safe your home is and how safe your church is by how safe you want it to be. You determine how safe your home is and how safe your church is by the stories kids have been brave enough to share. You determine how safe this place is. You determine how safe your home is by the stories kids have been brave enough to share. And for some of us, there's a tension. And here's what I want to ask you to do. Just go and see for yourself. Because watch this, as incredible as your pastor and staff are, there are some things that don't need to be said through a microphone. And let me tell you why. Because through a microphone, you can't see the white of my eyes. And with a microphone, I can't listen. And the next generation has stories. And they have unprocessed doubt. In fact, Kara Powell, one of the great next generation minds in our country, said that the doubt is not harmful. It doesn't, doubt and uncertainty is not harmful and doesn't hurt the next generation. It's unprocessed doubt that's harmful. Would you go and see for yourself? Would you name what is broken? And here's what's beautiful. But of course, for the sake of the next generation, but of course, I'll do that. And we get an extra cool chance to apply all of this week. Because here's what all of us know. Some of you've got family coming over, and isn't the tension around the Thanksgiving table everything that nobody will talk about? And you've got a chance to love. Let me pray for us. Jesus, I ask for all of us in this room that you would give us an uncanny ability to cut through emotion that has us so incredibly choked up that we can't even breathe. Because here's what we know. Whether it was a son, a daughter, a grandchild, a niece, a nephew, for those in this room who parent toddlers in elementary age, they see this and they're so fearful. Here's what we lean into tonight, Jesus. We lean into you, our hope, our sustainer, our redeemer, our comforter, our counselor, who gives us supernatural wisdom, who gives us unbelievable courage to do the difficult thing, to have a really hard conversation, but even more importantly, to simply become a place that is a person who is safe. I'm thankful for the example of Nehemiah, who named what was broken and went to see for himself. I pray tonight there would be a parent, there would be a friend, there would be a grandparent that would pick up the phone, go to somebody's house, and just give the next generation a hug. They would love them. But even more so, they would begin the hard, difficult work of rebuilding what is broken. And we pray this in the only name that matters, the name of Jesus.